Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. How can culture reshape our interpersonal relations and counteract widespread social and political oppressions? What everyday resistances can we offer to harmful macro-level social forces? And how does this refine understandings of our political agency and personal responsibility? These fascinating and urgent questions animate the work of my faculty colleague and guest today, Dr. Sharon Marcourt of Gustavus's Modern Languages, Literatures, and Cultures Department, the French section, and Gender, Women, and Sexuality Studies Program, or GWSS, which she also directs. Dr. Marcourt earned her BA in French with a minor in studio art at the University of Akron and her PhD in French at the University of Michigan. She joined Gustavus as an associate professor in 2018, having taught here in a visiting position 3 years earlier. Her teaching experience also encompasses the University of Michigan, the University Paris 7, aka Diderot University, the University of Houston, where she received that institution's Teaching Excellence Award, and Wilfrid Laurier University in Canada. At Gustavus, she teaches beginning and intermediate French, as well as courses in French on Paris for Misfits and Revolution and Rebellion in Modern French Culture, and courses in English on Feminism and Testimony and Gender, Sexuality, and the Holocaust. Along with teaching, she's an active scholar, authoring the book On the Defensive, Reading the Ethical and Nazi Camp Testimonies, co-editing a volume of essays on Auschwitz survivor Charlotte Delbo, publishing peer-reviewed articles and book chapters, and presenting at conferences and symposiums both in the U.S. and abroad. As a member of the Faculty Curriculum Committee, she and her committee colleagues have led the implementation of our new General Education Challenge curriculum, No Small Task. As a historian interested in culture, agency, and resistance to oppression, I've been looking forward to learning more about Professor Marcourt's work and biography, and I'm delighted she could join me to talk about both. So Sharon, welcome to Learning for Life. It's so great to have you on.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. It's great to be here.
Pleasure.
In my office, I guess.
You're in your office. Yeah, I'm here in Minneapolis, downtown Minneapolis, the wonders of technology. Which reminds me, without technology, I don't know, I always think about what would we have done if it were 1918 without all of this technology. What's it been like for you as a prof during the pandemic? Were you teaching? I mean, I guess we all had to teach online initially, but then did you go hybrid? Or just tell us a little bit about what that experience has been like.
Well, yeah, last year I spent entirely online, so last academic year. And then this year I've been back in the classroom completely, not doing anything hybrid. I mean, it was a steep learning curve, I think, for everybody. Yeah. Now it seems like the distant past when I didn't know how to use Zoom. but in the beginning, it was just, you know, the simple rudimentary things like, is my microphone working? And even having to teach students that. None of us knew how to do this stuff, right?
That's true. That's true. I mean, that's just a quick aside. I mean, my experience with the student, you know, this idea, young people know, no, and not really. They may know how to, I don't know, search for games or surf the web. But honestly, they don't know any more than we do, it seemed to me. their learning curve was just as steep. Had you taught online before? I had not.
No, I hadn't. I'd occasionally done office hours online, but using Skype, which is apparently no longer a thing. I'd never taught online before, and I was terrified the first few times where like my internet would cut out at home in those first 3 months, and suddenly I'm trying to get to my very important point I'm trying to make, and I drop out of the
you just triggered a repressed memory in me, which is I forgot that like at the whole God, it was weeks when we went online. I guess it would have been spring of 2020. And into the fall, we live in a condominium building downtown Minneapolis. Our neighbor was remodeling. So in the background of every class was all kinds of construction noise. Anyway, I don't know how were you teaching language? Were you teaching French online?
So I was teaching a 300 level course. So it's very different. Okay. The students already have a really strong level. And so do not need as much help with things like pronunciation. Okay. It's more like teaching a course in English that's in French, right?
Okay,
I was teaching a course on graphic novels.
Ooh, cool.
And that also helped because it's a really visual format. And that's something that Zoom can actually be good for, is you can have just a still image that people are studying.
Yes.
So that ended up, it was okay. I did one class a week that was synchronous, and okay. The other ones were group work where they were working on their writing.
Yeah.
So it ended up, yeah, it was, the French side wasn't all that difficult. But it was only because of the level. Last year, I also right. taught mostly upper level courses. The only difficulty is I was teaching one of our bridge courses that sort of bridges the intermediate sequence with the upper level courses. And students who are struggling with some of the concepts, it's much harder to help them with their French online.
That's what I figured. Yeah, I wondered about that. That's kind of what other people have said, language instructors. Yeah, it's so interesting. What, you know, you just mentioned that one positive feature of Zoom. I mean, is that maybe not the only one? Are you thinking of continuing with any of the tech stuff we had to use? I mean, I'm asking because I never used, I mean, I hardly used YouTube, I mean, but I'm going to use more. I'm just kind of getting at what, is there anything that will continue on for you or has continued on for you?
So one thing that I've kept doing that I really enjoyed as an activity was having students collaborate on brainstorming Google Docs in class. Mm-hmm. So that was something that I did on Zoom, and I've been doing it this year as well. And for me, it's a much better way of having a record of all of the ideas that people might be bringing up than the
yes.
chalkboard.
Yes.
Because a lot of times when you're up on the using the chalkboard and you know you're in this big brainstorming session about a reading, about an idea that you're engaging, you see that students aren't taking notes.
Right. I know.
And so when you break them up into groups and then you have them collaborating on smaller parts in a Google Doc, and then they're sharing the Google Doc with everybody, people can be engaging the Google Doc and then they have a record. And I found that it makes their writing much more detailed and they're engaging quotes from texts much more, things like this. So that's one thing that I'm going to keep. I've also gotten a lot less. I used to be one of these people who would always tell students like, don't have your computer open.
Yeah, me too. No, same
and,
here.
And I've changed with that now. I mean, there's still some students who are doing things that they shouldn't be during class time,
yeah.
and you can see that. But
sure.
the bulk of them aren't. They're actually
right.
using their computers to take notes. So I think it's also affected the way that students learn.
Yes.
They're taking notes on their computers a lot
yes.
more than they used to.
I agree with that. I've noticed that for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good point, too. I mean, it's not just how has the pandemic affected how we teach, but how students learn and what continuities there might be. I like what you're saying about the Google. I haven't tried that. I definitely am using the, what is it called, Moodle forum posts or Moodle forum feature, which I found really interesting. It was required. I mean, they did it. And yeah, I mean, instead of trying to keep track of who was saying what on the blackboard, I could go look and they could look at what, you know, they could also respond to one another. And some really insightful, not always, but other, you know, often really insightful comments. And yeah, as I had a record, I could look at that before class, right? Come back to it and make sure that what people had written, was addressed or at least acknowledged. So we shall see. Yeah, here we are back in person. At least you are. I'm on leave. And are students masked or what's going on in the classroom?
Yeah, students are masked.
Okay.
So that is currently the state of things. And, you know, with the masking, it feels pretty safe in the classroom. And I would say that was the case in the fall as well when we had the big Delta wave going through.
Yeah, I agree. I was, I finally came back, like you, I was all online from the time in March 2020. I didn't want to do hybrid ever, partly because of my age. But anyway, went back to the classroom this past fall and felt really good. It was a little strange with the masks. In a way, I missed being able to see their faces. At least I could see their full faces on screen. But felt safe, yeah. And so far, so good. So knock wood, as they say.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little, before we get to your work, which I am anxious to hear more about as I tried to make clear in my intro. Let's talk a little bit about your background. Tell us where you grew up, for example, and how you wound up at the University of Akron.
Yeah, well, so I grew up just outside of Akron, Ohio. That's kind of the very short version of the story. I had intended to go elsewhere for college. And so I had sort of been choosing between either going to Penn or going to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And then, my family had a horrible sort of crisis instability that made it so that I no longer had the extra financial abilities to be able to go to any of those schools. And Akron had offered me a full scholarship.
Oh, wow.
And so that ended up becoming the best choice when suddenly there was this financial crisis. So that's the very short version of how I went to the University of Akron.
Were you in high school? Were you already, were you studying French? Or were you interested in French?
Yeah, I had started French in, it was in middle school. Madame Armstrong was my first French teacher. And I picked it up pretty quickly. I had always been a musician as a kid. And there's supposed to be a lot of overlap between those. Because like your sense of hearing and rhythm and all of that is required for speaking another language.
Right.
So, and then I hadn't intended to study French when I went to undergrad. I had actually started out as a biology major.
That's right. I love that. Yeah.
And I ended up realizing that it wasn't for me, not because of grades. I had straight A's. I did everything just great, but I didn't care about it. So I actually ended up switching to painting as my major. When I was an undergrad, you still had to go into the dean's office to submit the paperwork in person to them to change your major.
I remember doing that too. That was true where I went to school. Yeah.
And they actually laughed at me when I was switching from biology to painting. Then I ended up, I was doing French the entire time because I was in this class with a really great professor who just taught these really cool texts, and I just ended up doing French as my major instead.
That's also interesting. Yeah. I love when it's not a straight line, you know, because as I've said a million times on this podcast, and you know, as a professor, so many students and parents sometimes think, you know, I have to have it all figured out, right? I have to, oh my God, my major, it's the most fateful decision I'll ever make. No, actually, it's one of the least, you know, consequential decisions you'll ever make.
And it's too much pressure. It's too much pressure in the beginning, right? Because, I mean, what it ends up, you have to have confidence in yourself. You have to be able to express yourself well. You need to show that you're responsible. There's all of these other skills that you're able to develop through whatever major you're choosing. I mean, I have a friend who was a theater major as an undergrad, and now he is the site master for the what is it called? Management Information Systems program at UC Berkeley. He was a theater major.
I love those stories so much. That's not my own case. I sort of loved history as a high school student, and then one teacher after another, I just kind of was straight history. But I love those stories about people who start out, you know, A and wind up Z or something, and they're all over the place, those stories. And you know, even in history, I can think of people who Warren Beck. I mean, Beck Hall. I don't know if you teach in Beck Hall ever, but
no,
Beck Hall, which is a lot of listeners know, really, you know, awesome new, relatively new building on campus. I mean, Warren Beck was a history major and then got into commercial real estate partly through marriage. I mean, his father was into that, but he was also good at it. I don't think he ever took a single accounting. And then just the other day, Jim Hearn, a history major and tennis star graduate, 82 grad. He's in commercial real estate. I don't know. There's something about history and commercial real estate, maybe. But, you know, you can do, I mean, you can, right, exactly what you just said. I mean, rarely, and students will tell me this, or former students, you know, rarely does an employer say, gee, you've got everything, if ever, right? You've got everything we're looking for. Sorry, you majored in French or theater. Well, it just doesn't happen. So, yeah, we need to work on that still. You know, there's so much anxiety around that on the part of students. Well, did your parents, speaking of that, did your parents expect you to major in something like biology, or that was something you just were interested in?
So I think the flip side of the underrepresentation of females in the sciences that I experienced was that if you showed any ability at sciences, you were being pushed into it. So I felt, I really felt there was this idea that because I was smart and I was a female, that that's what I should be doing.
Okay.
Even though I had interests in lots of other things.
Yeah.
In my high school, I won the science award. I won math award.
Oh, wow.
That was who I was. It was funny, even when I applied to grad school, my scores on the GRE, on the quantitative reasoning and on the analytic reasoning were like, I should have been going to engineering grad school or something. The scores I had on that, my verbal score was actually normal, just average.
That's funny. You're reminding me that I don't remember the details, but I know this was in high school, I should have, all these tests you take, whatever, to determine what you're going to be in life. I think it was biology or chemistry, and that just wasn't for me. I mean, not that I didn't like them, but, it's funny. Yeah. So here you are. You you pursued French in graduate school. But when did you go abroad? Because those experiences seem really important. Was that at Akron, your first trip abroad as a student?
Yeah. So let's see. I think it was I did undergrad in 3 years. It's hard to know when I was a sophomore or a junior, right?
Yeah.
So I think it was between my sophomore / junior year and my senior year that I did a study abroad in the French Alps. It's pretty great. Lived with a host family. And I actually had a pretty interesting experience with that because I actually lived with a family who lived in public housing. So this isn't the experience most people have when they go abroad.
Was that by choice or how did that happen?
They were just one of the families that was part of the group in that town that was part of the exchange program.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
And so, so here I was living in public housing at the base of a mountain.
Wow. What was that public housing like compared to what we think of when we think of public housing in this country?
Well, so this was more, it probably seemed a bit more like an assemblage of one-story condos.
Mm.
I wouldn't say that it was deluxe in that kind of way, but the family that I was living with, they were retired. That's I think part of where, what their financial situation was.
Right.
But I got home cooked meals every day. The family I was living with ran the association that was in the town for the study abroad. So
that's great.
In some ways it's a really enlightening experience about social class. I think that we often, it still happens that we demonize not having money as your sole pursuit in life, as your value.
Right. That's really cool. I think, when did you go to Spain and Morocco? Was that in graduate school?
Yeah. So Spain, you're making me think of
That's
years.
Okay.
This is not good.
It's in general. I think it was in, yeah.
Spain, I was there it was in my third year of grad school, I believe. So yeah, I went and I enrolled at the University of Salamanca. Which is in sort of the western part of Spain. And I took courses there. Morocco was just a long trip that I took at one point. That was actually fairly recently. That was 5 years ago.
Oh, wow. Love to go there. I've never been to Spain either. Yeah. I just think this, as an undergraduate, I went with my then girlfriend, we would have said, but she was fluent in Spanish. We went to Mexico for a semester, changed my life in so many ways to this day. So I just think, we have a lot of, I don't know the figures, but a lot of our students study abroad. I just think it's so important. It can be a number of guests on the podcast, colleagues and students have talked about how transformative it was to go abroad.
Yeah.
So, I mean, You go ahead.
I mean, so I also, I worked as a nanny. This is something that's not in my,
That's not in your CV.
Yeah, it's not in my CV. But yeah, I worked as a nanny in Toulouse, France. At one point. And I worked for somebody who was a high ranking person in Monsanto.
Wow.
Which at the time I didn't know what that meant.
A French family or US?
Yeah, a French family. Yeah, a French family. Monsanto is a French company.
That's cool.
So it was very interesting to get an experience like that.
You had the spectrum, social class spectrum, maybe.
I mean, yes. Yes, throughout France.
Yeah, that's neat. So you go on to graduate school. You go to the University of Michigan, great school. And how did you come to your dissertation topic?
So I actually, when I went to grad school, I thought that I was going to work on 19th century French poetry. So yet again, I went in thinking this is what I'm going to do. Yeah. And I was in a program that was really wanting people to explore. So you'd say, I want to do this. When you come in and they say, okay, we don't care. you're gonna explore. So I really just dove into the courses that I was taking. And at one point, there had been a professor who had been on sabbatical in my first year, and I had really wanted to take a class with him. But then in my second year, he wasn't offering one. So, or not a graduate level course, but okay. He was offering an undergraduate level course that I could at least visit. So I audited that course, and it was on the Holocaust. I one of the books that they were reading in the course was by Charlotte Delbo. I read the book. I loved the book, and then I've now written about Delbo in two books.
You're sort of the expert on her. Is that her memoir? I've never read anything by her.
This is her trilogy, Auschwitz and After. She would have rejected the label of memoir. Okay. So I think it technically is published in a series by the Edition de Minuit that's called Documents. I would call it a witness text or a testimony if I were to label it. The first volume was actually written immediately upon her return. So in 46 and 47.
And French, right?
Obviously. Yes. Yeah. She's French. The other volumes get written like 20 years later. So those might be more memoir, but she has a whole, you know, theoretical ideas about memory and things like that that cause her to reject memoir.
While we're talking about her, let's tell us a little bit more about her life, if you would, and you know, what drew you to her?
Yeah. So, first of all, I teach Auschwitz and After here in my Holocaust course, and it's the text that always grabs students. So there is just something to say for a great text. Sure. It's the one absolutely. That students then will just read afterwards. They'll read extra ones.
Thank God for great text. Every teacher needs. Yeah, seriously.
She has her family were actually Italian immigrants to France. And she, when she was quite young, she became very politically active. And she was also really in the French theater scene. And a lot of people don't know that in the 20s and 30s in France, the theater scene was a huge political arena. She worked as a secretary for one of the biggest actors in France at the time, a man named Louis Jouvet. He had a few film roles, but he was mainly a theater guy. And her husband was actually a high-ranking member of the Communist Party. And he ended up being the personal chaperone for the French surrealist poet André Breton during World War II. Wow. She was very politically connected, and her relationship with the Nazi camps is that she joined the French Resistance. So she joined the French Resistance, but then there was a theatrical tour that that this person she worked for, Louis Jouvet, was taking in South America. So she was actually in South America when all of the people in the resistance started to get arrested. So one of her really close friends got arrested, and she decided to go back to France when she could have stayed in South America.
Wow.
And yeah, so she and her husband then started running a clandestine press that produced anti-Nazi literature. And they ended up getting captured. Her husband was, 2 months after their capture, he was executed by firing squad. And she ended up, 8 months after that, being deported to Auschwitz.
Wow. Was her husband a writer, or what was he?
He was just a political activist.
Political activist, okay.
Yeah. And she then... something else that's really distinct about her is that the group of people with whom she was deported to Auschwitz actually had the highest survival rate of any group that was sent to the camps. And so they're really known for the kinds of collective behaviors they engaged in the camps in order to survive. There's this myth that we have about the Nazi camps, and in some ways it's really justified, that it was survival of the fittest, everyone for themselves, and that that's the way that you have to act in these kinds of situations. Delbo's group is actually a case that shows that it isn't. And that's one of the things that I've found so interesting about her, that in the midst of disaster, it's actually important to have a collective mindset.
Yeah. What can you give us an example of some of the things they did collectively?
Well, so some of them are very simple. So they would talk to each other. A lot of people couldn't do this because they weren't grouped with similar linguistic communities, right? And this was specifically a case with a lot of Jewish deportees to the camps, right? They'd be coming from all over the place.
Right.
And so not everybody spoke Yiddish. And,
right.
It was specific what they would talk about, right? They would talk about crazy plans they have for after things, you know, when things are done, I'm going to do this. Or they'd try to just remember specifics of things together, like what the metro stops were, right? What the names of the subway stops were, to keep their memory alive.
Yeah.
You know, they reconstructed a play together by Molière and performed it.
Wow.
which seems absurd, right? You're in the Nazi camps. Why are you doing this? But they did all of this to sort of keep group bonds. Other things, while they were standing at roll call, was every morning 4 a.m. They had to stand up for hours while the camp guards would just walk around and look for weakness in people. They would rub each other's backs to keep each other warm, or the people who were in front would get supported by the people behind them. They'd hold them up with their arms in ways that the Nazis couldn't see.
Sure.
So they were always looking for gaps in the system and looking for ways to exploit them somehow. Another thing they would do, they would actually help in as many ways as they could their weakest members. So they would share bread. Right. They would, Delbo herself she was suffering from severe dehydration and started to just act crazy in the camps. And they would stop her from doing things like running right in front of a dog that would then maul her if she did that. So they would look to protect people. So I don't know if those are good enough examples.
Yeah, yes, they are. And all of this, first of all of this relates to the two questions you posed that I read at the start of my introduction, right? I mean, resistance, interpersonal relations and political agency, all that stuff. It's really interesting. It certainly counter the image of the camps as a kind of totalizing place, which I know scholars have, at least the scholars I'm familiar with, and in the history of American slavery too, or U.S. slavery, have moved away from. You know, these people had some agency, right? Were able to. I know agency is a problematic concept, but at least for some historians. But you know, they exercise some agency in the face of horrible constraints.
I mean,
go ahead.
There are some ways in which you can understand. So, I mean, there's also a tendency. I actually see this less in my students now than I did a few years ago, but there's a tendency for people to also have a superiority complex about the camps and to think, oh, well, I would have done it better.
Right.
And so there's also, you do also need to counter that, right? And
yes.
This is one way in which the idea of, I mean, it became an ethical free zone, right? Like you can understand why, why those ideas are also important to have in mind, because you know what? I wouldn't have done as well of those as those people in the camps. And I can guarantee you that.
Yeah. That's interesting. That's a good point. I because I don't teach about the Holocaust. I get that a little bit sometimes when I'm teaching about slavery. That's interesting. There's the spectrum. I mean, at least thinking about, you know, slavery, there's the spectrum of the completely passive, you know, defeated enslaved person, and then the, you know, the Nat Turner, right? Yes. But of course, those are the two extremes. I mean, they existed, but it's all that stuff in between that's so important for you know, that's much more typical. That's what's hard, I think, to get some, at least for me, to get students to understand sometimes. Yeah. She sounds fascinating. I knew nothing about her. Yeah. Hadn't even heard of her until I started preparing for the podcast. Go ahead.
She also worked for the United Nations after. I mean,
I was going to ask you what she did after. Yeah.
It gets more and more incredible, right? She worked as a research assistant for Henri Lefebvre, who's a really,
wow.
Yeah. She's just this great, amazing background kind of presence throughout the 20th century in French intellectual history. And her trilogy really is, it's always the thing that knocks students over when they read it in a good way.
Well, so what she works for the UN, does she continue her activism after, after the war?
So one of the really complicated things about, post-war France is the status of the Communist Party. And so Delbo ends up actually renouncing her membership in the Communist Party and having many, many reasons for that. Largely the Stalinist turn. It wasn't necessarily a popular position to take right after the war, and she immediately did. She was still an activist, but she wasn't political, if that makes sense. Like, she wasn't affiliated with a political party anymore after her experience in Auschwitz, and then also after seeing ways in which the party really demonized a lot of survivors who came back. So she's really interested in her work in all of the people who fell through the cracks. She has a narrative about a guy who survived Auschwitz and then was accused of being the person who gave them away to the Nazis. And it wasn't the case. She really analyzes those kinds of moments in which because of the party's need to scapegoat or, you know, to find someone else to be responsible for things, the ways in which they would just engage in their own kind of dehumanizing behavior and rhetoric. And
that's so important. That history is, I know very little about it. I know a little bit about it, but really very little. But that's so important. It's a reminder for everybody, not just our students, that, you know, it's not like the war ends, you're liberated from Auschwitz or wherever, God forbid, and then everything is, you know, fine. I mean, it's not just the trauma, but you know, you're dealing with the Communist Party who, you know, thinks you're a traitor or,
yeah.
I mean, it's incredible. So does she stay in France the remainder of her life, or is she in the US too?
Yeah, she stays in France the remainder of her life, but her work actually gets received first in the US. Okay. So there was a professor at Sarah Lawrence who translated her works in the early 70s. And I think it's for a lot of reasons. There are a lot of reasons why Delbo was not first picked up in France. The myth of the French resistance it's still operative today, even in French culture. Narrating World War II is also a very male thing. Delbo promotes a different kind of value system in her writing. The U.S. doesn't have the kind of nationalist ties to how to represent the Nazi camps that France does.
Yeah. When you say different value system, I think you know what you mean. Could you just spell that out a little bit? She has a different value system. Go ahead.
So the narratives in France that tend to get the most widespread reception and tend to get picked up by the general public, especially following the war, are ones that can inscribe the experience somehow into a heroic vision,
sure,
or can present something masterful to say about it. And when I'm talking about that, I'm specifically thinking of the works of George Semprún, who's also somebody I've worked on a lot. He was a leading member of the Spanish Communist Party who had been in the French Resistance as well. And his works present grand theories about you know, the nature of art, the nature of memory. And Delbo's are much smaller theories, if that makes sense as a distinction.
Yeah.
She doesn't inscribe hers explicitly in a grand theoretical tradition. She's more interested in how, with all of this theoretical knowledge that I have, can I still treat others well? How can I not use them as props for my theories? Whereas you see that somebody like Semprún, people matter less than ideas to him.
which is not, I have to say, my experience, it's not unusual to encounter that, at least among people I know who are steeped in theory. I kind of sometimes want to say, remember, they're actual human beings here, living history. Yeah. She sounds absolutely fascinating. It makes me want to read. I will read her. It's a trilogy, as you say. I want to read it. Were you able to get to know, speak with her at all, or was she?
No, she died in the 80s.
Eighties. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's fascinating work, and congrats on that volume. And then the other work I want to talk about is the book you authored that I mentioned in the intro on the defense of reading the ethical and Nazi camp testimonies. Before we do that, you've written about or commented about what writing involves. I want to just read a couple of quotes. You're sort of speaking to students here, I guess, but you know, not just students. You can't just wait for inspiration to strike, you stated. And then you also said, good writing starts with good reading. There is a whole lot that goes into writing a book that you don't see at all. And I wonder if you could comment on those insights. And the last one just is music to my ears. I couldn't agree more. I haven't written a book, but I love writing. I can't stress enough to our students that writing and reading go together. But talk a little bit about what you meant there.
So where did those quotes come from?
those quotes come from, I've done my due diligence. Those quotes come from the Gustavian Weekly when there was reception for you and our colleague Blake Cooey for your first books.
I
think at the bookmark.
Well,
they're good quotes.
Well,
what was the year on that? The year was maybe 2015, maybe. I think. Yeah,
it was a while ago.
Yeah.
I guess one of the things that I feel like a lot of people don't have enough of an appreciation of is that the final thing that ends up becoming your piece of writing is nowhere near where you start.
Yes, thank
you. So you don't just sit down, write from introduction to conclusion, and ta-da, you're done, right? I know that a lot of us, as undergrads especially, that's how you could write papers. That's not how it works when you're publishing things.
Right.
And so there's a mechanics to researching and writing. And this is something that I'm always trying to teach my students, that you need to have good processes in place. You can't write for too much in a day, but you also can't write for too little, right? So you have to figure out what your rhythm is. And you have to actually just decide, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write. Maybe you're only going to write a sentence. Maybe you then end up erasing that sentence the next time that you
write. Right, but that's your writing time. That's when you sit down.
Yeah,
right.
You've got to do it. And a lot of it is, you know, I will go through and I will compile a whole list of the things that are most striking to me. That relate to the larger idea that I'm exploring. And then I whittle it down, and it's a lot of time spent doing that. I'm trying to think of other ways to describe the process. You know, most of the time, the thing that is your inspiring idea that you start with ends up not even ending, making it into your final draft.
That's true.
You know, there's also just, you know, I have a student that I'm working with right now who's a research assistant for me, and we've been collaborating on some writing right now.
That's
and
great.
One of the things that they've noticed is, you know, we started out saying, okay, here's what interests us about this. And then once you get into the flow of writing, you have to abandon things. And then you realize, oh, there's a word limit that this this thing has. Yeah. I've got to cut out two paragraphs. How do I do that? And so you can't get as attached to different parts of your writing yes. as you want to.
Yes.
So, you know, I remember an essay that I recently submitted. I think that I had like 5,500 words, and it was a strict 5,000 word limit. And that was imposed by the press. Like the people I was writing for would have been happy to have those 500 extra words, but the press just said, no, it's about right. money. We're not printing extra pages.
Yes.
So I think that having that awareness can help students a lot. And then also, you know, my introduction is the last thing I do.
I tell students that. Yeah, exactly.
My goals when I'm writing is, so, I mean, it probably, I hope that it shows when I'm talking about people like Delbo. I want people to read Charlotte Delbo. I think everyone's life would be better if they read her work. And so what I want to do in my writing is convince you that you should be reading Charlotte Delbo. And so I want that to shine through in what I'm writing. And so I want to pay tribute to these people that I'm working on and show you why you should engage their ideas in the detailed ways that I want to, why it's worth it, right? Why it's worth trying to get into somebody else's head for a while, and how rewarding of an experience that can be for you as a thinker, right? Because you've really gotten into the details of what somebody else is doing. And so, you know, my goal is, okay, I'm going to do this cool reading of this little passage. Oh, and I have to have an introduction that explains why people should care.
The thing I love about what you're saying, everything you just said in those quotes that you may not remember from the weekly webpack, is that, as I tell my students, I mean, it's sort of obvious, I guess, but, you know, writing isn't just what when you're sitting, putting stuff on paper. There is all these other parts of writing, right? So when you're thinking, when you're reading, when you're deciding what to cut, what to include, that's all writing. I mean, all of that is part of writing. And I tell them, I'll never forget this. The author Tim O'Brien years ago came to Gustavus, and, you know, Minnesota author, and most famous maybe for his novel, the Things They Carry, or Carried, whatever. And what I remember, he said either it was like at least 90% for sure. Maybe it was 99%. I don't remember. It was a dinner with a group of us. Of his writing was editing. Mm. Right. I mean, that was his right. I mean, you know, the actual writing part, 10% or less, it was the editing, the deciding what to include, what to cut, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I think, you know, the problem is when we're undergraduates, we're like doing it at the last minute, you know. Yep. So,
I remember I did it too.
we all did. Same here. Yeah. But I'm like you, I tend to write, I want to just start writing. So I'll start analyzing, you know, some piece of something. And then the intro will usually come last, right? Kind of when I have a sense of where I've been, what I want to say. So, I want to talk about the book, as I just mentioned, On the Defensive. Thanks for all those insights on the defensive, reading the ethical and Nazi camp testimonies. What is that book about? It sounded to me from the little, I haven't read the book, but the little research I did preparing for the podcast, that it's really, I don't know if it's fair to call it a revisionist work, but you're kind of presenting an argument that isn't quite typical about Holocaust testimonies. Go ahead.
So I wish that I had the book right in front of me, because then it would be, I feel like I'd have a better way of presenting what I do in the book. But so largely, I'm interested in, I guess I would say, topics related to the Holocaust that make more people feel uncomfortable, or make people feel uncomfortable who aren't used to being made to feel uncomfortable, who are interested in the Holocaust. So in that book, I'm really interested in the problematic ways that well-intentioned people engage Holocaust testimonies. And so people who have this sense that they are ethical, right? People who engage this because they're good people, right? I'm a good person. I engage the Holocaust, and the things that those people do wrong. So the harms that people can cause to both our memory of the event and also to you know, one thing I devote a lot of time to is analyzing how those people in particular actually engage survivors in the aftermath.
So let me just say real quickly. Sorry. Yeah. You're really looking at, it's not the writers of the testimonies. It's more the people engaging with those testimonies. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. And the, okay. the writer, well, so, I mean, it's a bit more complicated than that, I guess, because sure. This is a big critique that actually, so Delbo is somebody I talk about in this book, and this is a big critique that Delbo actually has that comes out through her work and that I argue actually informs a lot of the things that she's doing rhetorically in the text, the kinds of readers she's trying to engage, the strategies that she's using to engage them. And then on the flip side, this other writer I was telling you about, George Semprun, you can see actually a lot of these harms being done to others being played out in his texts. He was somebody who was able to be kind of the voice of a generation once he started publishing. And you can see the ways that this stamped out a lot of voices within the survivor community.
Okay. So I'm an ethical person. Let's just stipulate that. And I come to some of these testimonies. Give us some examples, or at least one example of where I go wrong, what I do wrong.
Well, so so let's see. A good example of something. Well, so the basic argument that I pursue is that people come in with a sense of that they're ethical. They get into these encounters and they realize, oh wow, this is much more complicated than I thought. And then they start to engage in an array of defensive behaviors. Okay. So they'll start doing things like obsessing with something that isn't what the survivor's actually talking about, right? So they'll obsess about this one fact as opposed to what the survivor is trying to actually say in their narrative. You know, another thing is that they might appropriate the person's experience, right? Yes. Or they'll engage in these kinds of condescending behaviors like, oh, it's all in the past. Oh, it's all fine now. There's actually a lot of work on this in psychology about how people who are respondents to trauma testimonies act in the face of others' trauma.
Wow, so fascinating.
And so you see this happening in these works, and you see it at work, and this was actually a time before we actually had a concept of trauma that doesn't enter into the official diagnoses, psychological trauma, until 1980. So all of these people are writing before we actually have any of these concepts to guide what we're thinking about, but you see it all playing out in their works. So those are a few examples, but yeah. I mean, a lot of it too is what is it that people's loved ones might have been doing in the aftermath? And so actually trying to help them too much, right? Trying to not let them actually experience their trauma. Right? One of the things that's really, really important when people are having traumatic episodes, when people are experiencing PTSD, is don't make them repress it, right? Repressing it, making them not be able to actually express it, this is something that actually causes long-term harm. And so a lot of the things that people thought they were doing to help with alleviating people's trauma was actually compounding it.
Wow, that's so fascinating. I mean, it relates to, I was thinking about psychology, memory, the whole concept. You said appropriated trauma, I think, or appropriation of trauma, which is, I mean, the president of Luther College, Jennifer Ward, who is a friend and used to teach German at Gustavus, I mean, she's used that phrase, appropriated trauma. I mean, where, you know, kind of, you know, everything, you know, from among faculty, students, everything kind of rises to, you know, DEFCON 10 and you're in some horrible traumatic, you know, and really, I mean, seriously, compared to, you know, but anyway, that all sounds incredibly interesting. Makes me want to read your book. And it sounds like, is it, would you say it's an interdisciplinary book or?
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, I engage a lot of, I mean, whenever you write on the Holocaust, it somewhat verges into history, right?
Yeah, sure.
But
I'm not
a historian. I'm I come at things through the lens of literary and cultural studies.
Yes.
A lot of it, I engage a lot of French philosophy because a lot of philosophical work in France that's post 1945 engages the Holocaust. It's just a major event that influences people's thought.
Yes, I've read none of that, and I only know that in general that's the case. Do you engage work on trauma as well? I mean,
I do. Yeah. So the field called trauma theory.
Yeah.
So I engage more the sort of the literary side of that rather than actual psychological work on trauma, but it all draws from psychological work on trauma.
Yeah.
I also engage photography.
Ooh, wow.
So my My conclusion is actually a reflection on a series of photos that were taken of a convoy of Hungarian Jews that was deported to Auschwitz in late 1944. Wow. And so there's actually photos of people standing right outside of the doors to the gas chambers.
Oh, Jesus. Sorry. That's first of all, I love visual culture and photographs. So that alone makes me want to read your book, as difficult as that must have been to write about and will be to read about. Yeah. This, you said convoy, which triggered right away this a convoy, right, stalled, I guess, outside of Kyiv. Mm-hmm. But we think about, I'm just thinking of all the images coming at us from this. Someone has said, I don't know if it's really true, but the first social media war with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Who knows what people will be writing about.
There's a lot that I'm thinking about with the fall of France when this, I mean, because at the start of World War II, France fell very quickly. I mean, there was a lot more buildup than there was right now with Ukraine. I think the invasion of Poland may actually be a better example better comparison. But I mean, just, I mean, I've read a lot of accounts of people fleeing Hitler when Hitler sort of, you know, comes around through Belgium and attacks France. And just the scenes in my head and the way that that's making me experience the Ukraine invasion, right? Fleeing, like, even if they're not on the front lines where the tanks and the soldiers and the death squads, right? We know that there are Russian death squads right now. That's not even, I mean, that is horrifying. And what we're also missing, though, is just in the chaos, right, of that mass of people fleeing, all of the things that are happening, right? Like if you have diabetes, right? If you have a heart condition, these things.
All the everyday. Yeah, exactly. Are you giving birth, or you just gave birth? Yeah. That's an excellent, all of those are excellent points. And it's also fascinating. You're making me think about how we, you know, in your case, the scholarship you've done really on France, you know, and the Holocaust and how that affects how you're seen and understanding what's happening in Ukraine right now. I mean, it is the law, right? It's the worst refugee crisis since World War II, really. I mean, it's just awful.
As long as we aren't thinking about Syria.
Yeah, no, I know. There's Syria and Russia. There's, oh my God, there's, it's just Libya, it goes on and on.
Yeah.
As soon as I came across those quotes that I started the intro with, I thought of, you know, now of Ukraine and also our own country. But I think those were really important questions you ask about resistance and culture. The book sounds fantastic. I look forward to reading it and maybe even sitting down with you and having some coffee to talk about it in a French way, of course, coffee. you were saying before we started
recording.
I don't either. I don't smoke either, but the coffee. Yeah, right. We don't smoke. So I want to talk now in the time remaining. I want you to talk a little bit, please, about the GWSS program, Gender, Women, and Sexuality Studies program at Gustavus, which you direct. I mean, speaking of interdisciplinary, tell us a little bit about that program. What's distinctive about it? Why it's important in the context of a liberal arts college named Gustavus?
Well, one of the things that we are really interrogating a lot is questions of identity in the Gender, Women, and Sexuality Studies program. And, these are difficult conversations to engage in the classroom, but it's something that we really take seriously. And in this cultural moment that we're in, I think it's a really, really important sort of role that we're playing at the college. Right now, I'm teaching our sort of gateway to the major course called Feminist Controversies, and we're dealing with the concept of intersectionality. So we're doing all of these readings about intersections of gender, race, class, sexuality, thinking about what it is to have multiple identities that are pulling you in different directions or oppressing you from different directions.
Right. And at a moment when some state legislatures are trying to, you know, literally outlaw those identities, right? Yes. Teaching about them. Yeah.
Yeah. And in the final section of the course, we actually do a lot of readings that directly link misogynistic repression and repression of sexuality to the far right. So there's a lot of work on that in feminist scholarship. But other things that are really interesting about what we do is that we kind of span the college, and we've been in a moment in the last few years where we've really been rethinking ourselves. In part, it's out of necessity because we've had a lot of retirements, And a lot of people who have you know moved on to other duties at the college, but in part also because it's just been a great time to engage in all of these other conversations. So we have, for example, we have a professor in the physics department, Darsa Donnellan, who has started teaching a course for us called The Disordered Cosmos: Race, Gender, and Science. I got to see them teach this course in JTRIM this year. It's absolutely incredible.
She doesn't know yet, but I'll be reaching out to her about recording with her too. So that's good to know.
You know, we have a whole bunch of, you know, we have a new course on race and sexuality that's going to be taught in the fall by a new faculty member in the philosophy department, John Gill. We have a course currently being taught by a new faculty member in French on Black women in Europe. And your colleague in history, Kate Aguilar, is teaching a whole bunch of courses on African American history and race and sport that are from a gender, women, and sexuality studies kind of angle. So we've had a lot of change in recent years, but I think it's been change for the good ultimately. And it's just a really fascinating time to be in the program. Director is not really a role that I ever associate with myself. I kind of feel like I'm the chaos controller or I really like to think of it as we're all kind of in it together. And I just have to be the one to, you know, submit paperwork.
Exactly. You do the paperwork. That's what I was going to say. Right. Exactly. Right.
But we're other really good things that we're doing. We share our research with each other. So we have little informal research gatherings where we talk. We do little coffee breaks that have mostly been on Zoom in the last few years. We're going to have an event where we're going to be remembering the feminist writer Bell Hooks, who just passed away in December. Yeah. Yes. And in true feminist fashion, we're all going to sit around and eat donuts.
it's a thriving, just listening to you talk about it, it's highly interdisciplinary, extremely interesting. I'm thinking back to, I've been at Gustavus 35 years, and my wife, Kate Winstein, and I came in a joint appointment. There was maybe women's studies, Patricia Dean, I think, but there was nothing like what we have now. So just thinking about where we've come and just the number of women faculty now at Gustavus, it's thriving. It's a thriving program, and it's a major. Is that right? Students can major in it.
It's a major and a minor.
It's really cool. It's
awesome. And our courses are always packed every semester, so they always fill, and then we're normally having to bring in students over the cap. I think it's a space that students are seeing as important for the kinds of discussions that they want to be engaging in, and I think that a lot of our students have also realized that they have to take these questions seriously. Yes. And if they're not going to talk about them, nobody's going to help them think through them, right?
So we've got to
the classroom is their opportunity to do that. And I think that a lot of students are seeing how their identities are under attack.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, no question about that. Literally under attack and legal, legislation, at least potentially. And we use that word moment, right? Scholars, our moment. Let's hope it's really a moment, and passes quickly.
I was in Texas for 4 years, and I can't help but think about what's been going on over the last months with the abortion legislation that was introduced.
The transgender.
Just the effects the effects that has on people's everyday lives. And I think our students are seeing why, you can't ever think that your rights are fully secured.
Secure. You are. That is a profoundly important point, which I've come to appreciate more as a historian and as a person. Exactly right. And this idea that you secure rights, then there's a backlash. The backlash is ongoing. It's constant, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. And you must be constantly. That's why feminism is in waves.
Yeah, exactly. You must be constantly struggling, whatever words we want to use, to secure your rights. You cannot assume, okay, secured, check. And I do think some people on the left and some liberals have made that mistake. Those rights are always going to be under attack, always threatened. In any case, that's another podcast. I know we're running out of time here. You've got another meeting to get to, but just quickly, if you would, I wonder, because you've had so much teaching experience at other institutions, What are your thoughts about how teaching at Gustavus is similar to different from those other institutions you've taught at?
Yeah, so you know the job I came from, you know, immediately before Gustavus, I was teaching in Canada, and the entire education system is just very, very different. But classes are a lot bigger. So I had a 100 student lecture that I taught on 20th century France. And our smallest seminar courses had 45 students in them. So,
good Lord. Wow.
it was a very different format. And one of the things that I'll say about just, you know, simple differences like class size. I mean, you can really engage everyone, which it's just not possible from that perspective. In a class of 45 students, necessarily there's going to be a few students who end up emerging as the dominant voices, because you just don't have the time with class management to make things run any other way. But here, you know, our students are ridiculously engaged. Actually, sometimes over engaged, right, with the number of clubs that people will be part
that's
of.
True.
And that's part of Gustavus culture. But even just things like one thing that I'll do in a lot of my classes is I'll be like, okay, here's the question. Everybody write four sentences for me. And, you know, respond to this through what we've been talking about. And, you know, you see students actually doing it. They're taking it seriously. Yes. They're engaging in that together, and they're revising things together in their groups. And that kind of constant participation, everybody always on, I think, you know, I'm not sure if that's a liberal arts more broadly phenomenon. It likely is. But I do think that there's also something about our students being so interested in thinking about issues of ethics and justice and thinking about really how to change things. Our students want to make a difference. And that's something I perceive.
I agree with you. And I only taught at, you know, TA, you know, I taught some independent courses at Boston University, you know, very, very different. Couldn't agree more with what you just said. And there's something, as one distinguished historian who came to Gustavus more than once and met some of my classes said, you know, the students aren't jaded. And I think there's some truth to that. I mean, that can become kind of a cliche bantied about at Gustavus, but I think there is some truth to that. And they want to learn. Not all of them, right? Some of them are just, you know, like at any place, but in general, as we like to say in our department, they do the reading, you know, and they actually have something to say about it. So this has been so much fun. Thank you. You have to go on to a meeting. That's our lives as professors. We go from one event or task to another. So it's been a pleasure. I look forward to reading more about Del Ball, reading her books, actually, and then your book as well, and talking over coffee. So thank you so much for making the time. Take good care.
Thank you, Greg.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by J.J. Aiken and Matthew Dobosensky of the Gustavus Office of Marketing. Gustavus graduate Will Clark, class of 20, who also provides technical expertise to the podcast, and me. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College.